Welcome to Farmed and Dangerous, a long-term memory radio series on the pharmaceutical industry. In a study released in mid-October 2002, researchers at the University of Toronto and the Hospital for Sick Children found that Canadians' use of antidepressants has soared by more than 300% over the past two decades. In this hour, Farmed and Dangerous features psychopharmacologist David Healy. Dr. Healy is author of The Antidepressant Era and The Creation of Psychopharmacology. He has also written many articles on the effects of medication on mood and brain function. David Healy was the central figure in a controversy involving the University of Toronto's Centre for Addiction and Mental Health. In late 2000, the university rescinded a high-profile job offer to Dr. Healy over comments he made about the antidepressant drug Prozac. That same year, the multinational drug company Eli Lilly contributed over $1.5 million to the Center for Addiction and Mental Health at the U of T. There was and still is speculation that the University of Toronto's dependence on the drug giant Eli Lilly influenced their decision. David Healy speaks to us from his home in Bangor, North Wales.
The introduction to your book, The Antidepressant Era, you say that the antidepressants occupy a place somewhere near the fulcrum of the healthcare system. Maybe you'd like to tell us what you meant by that.
There are treatments we have that clearly work and that you or I, if we were ill, would want to have them. There are other treatments, well, for which healthcare has been famous over the years. These are treatments that are actually delivered by quacks. These are snake oils of various sorts. The antidepressants occupy a point near the middle here where it's difficult to know at times whether they really work and do good and whether we should be trying to get people to have them on a wide scale or whether they're almost closer to snake oil and they don't really work and we should be a lot more cautious about them than we are. They're very much Janus-faced. They're looking both ways, it seems to me.
Perhaps we might go into the question of whether or not depression is a disease. Is there a chemical imbalance in the brain that accounts for depression?
I think what's happened, we've got to tease the issues apart. Over the last 100 or 200 years or so, well, actually, roughly speaking, about 150 years ago now, for the first time, people teased out the idea of a mood disorder. Up to about 150 years ago, when you went mad, when you went ill, when you had problems with your nerves, you either went insane. People thought that you had to be completely insane, that if there was anything wrong with your mind, all of your mind had to be deranged. About 150 years ago, people began thinking, well, when you get ill, it may just be that part of your mind gets ill. And they began to think in terms of what we would now think of as a mood disorder for the first time. Now, at the same time, there were the group of people who went into nervous hospitals to be treated for mental illness. And this was a very, very small group of people. There was a much larger group of people out in the community who had what we would now think of as being nerves. And people like this weren't thought of as being mentally ill. They were perhaps over-anxious. They were perhaps fatigued all the time. A range of problems that might now be thought of as being part of a mood disorder, but weren't then thought of as being part of a mood disorder. The idea of a mood disorder, up until the antidepressants came on stream, remained a fairly serious problem, the kind of problem that led to you needing to go to hospital, the kind of problem that led to you not only having what we would think of as being a low mood now, but also being possibly deluded, the kind of problem that left people fairly happy to treat you with ECT, for instance.
ECT being electroshock therapy?
That's right, yes. Now, with the antidepressants, what we have is where you might think if a treatment worked, that problems got cleared up. We seem to have had a vast increase in the number of people who now get thought of as having a mood disorder or get thought of as being clinically depressed. What's happened is that the pills probably don't work as well for the severely ill group of people as we like to think, although they do work. But what we've done is we've pulled into the net a huge number of the people who were always out in the community who had nerves prior to this, and they're now seen as actually being depressed, and they're being given pills like Prozac and Zoloft and Paxil. Whether they are depressed or not is a little less clear. This is very much the same group of people who 10 or 15 years ago were being given Valium and Librium and drugs like that. And it isn't clear that Prozac and Zoloft, for instance, work any better than Valium or Librium did previously.
So was depression invented as a disease?
Well, what pharmaceutical companies do is they don't usually invent things out of the blue. What they do is they pick up the things that are roundabout that suit their interest. For example, what you hear them talk about these days is you hear people talk about a disorder called compulsive shopping disorder. Oddly enough, this actually has been around for 70 to 80 years. So if pharmaceutical companies begin to market pills for this, they're not actually creating it out of the blue. Well, what they do is they do pick up the evidence that suits them, and people who actually use the drugs begin to hear more and more about this particular condition, and they sort of get all the clinical trials posted their way. They get the evidence about the condition sent to them. They get asked to meetings to hear about the condition, so that if you come in the door to be treated for your nervous problem, they'll be much more likely to ask you, well, what happens when you go out to shop, when you're feeling anxious, when you're feeling strained, when you're feeling tense? Do you resort to trying to take a retail therapy approach towards your nervous problems? Creating the syndrome out of the blue, but it's marketing the evidence.
Creating a market.
That's
or
right.
Identifying it as a market. Perhaps you'd like to describe briefly the role of the pharmaceutical industry in the history of psychiatric medicine, or perhaps, if that's too big a question, in the history of depression.
No, there's a few things that can be said reasonably simply. One is that what people fail to realize is that before these drugs came on stream, back 40 to 50 years ago, the pharmaceutical companies that we now think of as being major corporations, major worldwide corporations, whose share price until fairly recently has just gone up and up and up, these were fairly small groups. They were often not actually independent pharmaceutical companies, but they were groups within larger chemical companies. And with the advent of the new drugs 40 to 50 years ago, the larger chemical companies hived off their pharmaceutical divisions, and these began to grow in their own right. So 30, 40 years ago, people like me dealing with the industry would have been dealing with the industry from a position of power. Now you find that even if you're the head of psychiatry at the NIMH or whatever, you deal with the industry from a position with them in power. The clinical trials that used to get run 40 to 50 years ago were run by the major university departments who used to hold all of the results on file within the university. These days they get run by the pharmaceutical companies who hire university figureheads to be the apparent authors on the articles that come out of clinical trials, and all of the actual data from the clinical trials gets held within the pharmaceutical company. And if people like me working in the university that has been linked into a trial, for instance, wanted to access that data, we wouldn't be able to. So there's been a huge change in the way clinical people relate to the pharmaceutical industry over the last 30 to 40 years.
You have been quoted as having said that a significant proportion of scientific literature is now ghost-written. Is this what you're talking about?
Yes. Through the course of several legal actions that I've been linked to, I've had the opportunity to go into pharmaceutical company archives. And once you do that and begin to look at the process of how articles come out of clinical trials, what becomes awfully clear is that some of the major figureheads that we have within the world of psychiatry these days, whose names are on articles written for almost all of the pharmaceutical companies, almost certainly haven't written those articles. The articles begin life either within the pharmaceutical company itself or within medical communications agencies who work to the various pharmaceutical companies. And it's these agencies that handle the data that comes out of the clinical trials and that write up the articles, and then approach authors with a view to getting these authors' names on those articles.
Now, am I being naive in hoping that medical journals might be the last refuge of truth in medical science?
I think you are being fairly naive there. Yes, this is a process that actually applies to most of the major journals. It actually applies to the New England Journal of Medicine, to JAMA, the BMJ, to, say, The Lancet. It applies to all these journals because pharmaceutical companies feel that most people are going to believe articles that appear in those journals, and therefore they're quite keen to get their articles in those journals.
Of course, the BMJ, British Medical Journal, I think, printed an article in April by Moynihan and others.
Yes.
Claiming that there is disease-mongering by the pharmaceutical industry, so they're not completely sold over to the drug companies.
No, they aren't. But what does the BMJ do when it's faced with the article that comes out of a clinical trial that has been done by one of the companies, and it has the names of fairly distinguished people appearing as the authors? Well, up till recently, the BMJ would have just said, well, fine, these people are the authors, and the article actually ends up being published. More recently, what some of the major journals have organized is that they ask authors to actually declare that they are the authors. But the criteria for authorship these days aren't what you or I would understand an author to be, which is that, you know, the author is the person who writes the first or the early drafts of the paper. The author is a person who has access to the data from the clinical trials. If you look at the criteria that the BMJ are JAMA, or the New England Journal of Medicine, or The Lancet, require for authors, they simply require some input to the article. And it's the kind of loose criteria that I think will leave them open to having their journal penetrated by pharmaceutical company articles in much the same way that they have been penetrated for the last few years.
Psychiatrist, what other evidence have you seen that the pharmaceutical industry is in the business of selling psychiatric diagnoses as well as psychotropic drugs?
I think one of the interesting things is over the last 30 to 40 years, the major drugs that came on stream to treat nervous problems were actually discovered by chance. The hope had been that over the 30, 40 years after that, up till now, that we would have got to the point of understanding what's involved with the various different mental illnesses, the various different nervous problems, and we would have been rationally able to make drugs that would help these problems. However, we really haven't moved forward nearly as far as we had hoped, and we're producing fewer and fewer new breakthrough drugs, at least for nervous problems. Now, as this has happened, the industry has grown bigger and bigger, as I've outlined earlier. And really what's happened with that is they've become more and more able to market things to us. The bit of the industry that really works best is not the drug development bit, but actually the market development bit. This, I think, can be seen most clearly in the case of the SSRI group of drugs, Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, which came on stream during the 1990s as drugs to treat people who were depressed. They came on stream as drugs to treat people who were depressed because the industry felt at that time that they couldn't market tranquilizers or any new tranquilizers for people who were anxious because we'd all become very leery or wary about the idea of tranquilizers causing you to be hooked. What the industry did then was to market these pills for people who are depressed, but at the same time try and get the pills being used for people who are anxious, people who had social phobia, people who had post-traumatic stress disorder or whatever. In the wake of the events of September 11th, industry seems to have felt that what they can do is rebrand the SSRI group of drugs, which most people will think of still as being antidepressants. They can rebrand them as anxiolytics.
Don't tell me. Anti-anxiety? No, go ahead.
No. Anxiolytics. Simply just not calling them tranquilizers anymore. Calling them anxiolytics, industry feels, will be all it takes to get people using these drugs on a much bigger scale than before for people who are anxious.
So anxiolytics is an anti-anxiety drug?
Essentially, Valium and Librium were called tranquilizers, but they could have been called anxiolytics. The SSRIs are now being called anxiolytics, but they could have been called tranquilizers. The problem is, industry figures that the word tranquilizer still is a problem word. They've coined a new word for the same thing, and they figure this is all they need to do to sell the pass, not only to the public, but generally to the primary care physicians and the consultant psychiatrists who will be using these drugs for this purpose.
Your name became widely known in connection with the assertion that Prozac is connected with suicide. Are you aware of research that connects Prozac to suicide?
Yes, I am. Many, many years ago, when Prozac came on the market first, I had a number of people seeing me for clinical purposes who I put on Prozac or one of the other Prozac-like group of drugs and found that they actually became suicidal on these drugs where they hadn't ever been that way before. The problem cleared up once the drug was halted, and the problem reappeared when the person was put on either the same drug or one of the other drugs in the group. It turned out that industry themselves had a lot of evidence in this area, and within almost all of the major companies, quite a few of the senior people looking at these issues, looking at people being reported to them who had become suicidal on the drug, where the problem had cleared up once you'd halted and whether it had come back after you'd gone on the drug again, had said, yes, we think our drug causes these problems. Now, nobody outside of the companies actually got to hear about this, but as I said, I was fairly firmly convinced that the drugs could cause a problem and wrote one or two articles on this issue. This led to me being involved some years later, about 5 to 6 years later, in a legal action in the U.S., which involved a man who'd gone on Prozac, and after he'd been on Prozac for a little more than a week, he'd killed his wife and then killed himself. Being involved in this action meant that I had access to the archives from, first of all, Eli Lilly, who make Prozac, and then in later actions, I've been able to access the archives for Pfizer, who make Zoloft, and GlaxoSmithKline, who make Paxil. And in all instances, you see the same pattern that senior company people have recognized that their drug causes problems. But what's also clear now is they've done healthy volunteer work before these drugs ever came on the market, and the same problems that I had been seeing clinically and that others have been seeing clinically after the drugs came on the market were there in the healthy volunteers long before the drugs ever came to the market. And the clinical trials that brought the drugs onto the market, when you begin to add all the people in these trials who'd either kill themselves or tried to kill themselves, you see that there's a statistically significant greater incidence of people killing themselves on the SSRI than there is on either the drugs that it's been compared with or placebo.
Well, of course, this is the most extreme of extreme adverse drug reactions, but are there any other adverse drug reactions you'd like to mention in connection with Paxil, Zoloft, Prozac?
Clearly, yes, if people actually kill themselves, that's obviously, well, it's, as you say, fairly extreme. The thing about it is, I think with the proper kinds of warnings, the risk that anyone would kill themselves could be greatly reduced.
Reduced.
But one of the other things, yes, there is a further problem that's worth trying to outline quickly, which is that when this group of drugs came in the market first as antidepressants, people said, well, unlike the minor tranquilizers which went before them, the antidepressants aren't a group of drugs to which you can get hooked. It's now clear, I think, that the SSRI group of drugs are a group of drugs on which some people are going to become physically hooked. That is, when they try to halt the drug, they simply won't be able to.
This would fall under the category of things that people should know about antidepressant medication that they don't generally know.
Absolutely, yes. I think quite a few people would opt to still take treatment, even if they thought there was a risk of being hooked. But it is the kind of thing, yes, that they ought to know about before they actually go on the drugs. And it is the kind of thing that industry knew about before these drugs came on the market, even though they gave us all a completely different impression.
How do you account for the willingness of people by the thousands to take pills for depression?
Well, I think people have been sold the idea that if you're actually depressed, there are drugs there that will work. And they've also been sold the idea that if you're actually depressed, there's something wrong with, say, your serotonin system. And this sounds like almost an ethical thing to do, to put right something that you're told is wrong, and something that you're given the impression that putting it right is really no more hazardous than taking vitamin A or vitamin B or vitamin C. Vitamin Prozac is just going to top up the serotonin levels in your brain. Now, in actual fact, there's no evidence that there's anything wrong with the serotonin system in anyone who's actually depressed. So taking Prozac is not like taking vitamin A, B, and C. I think the other thing is that people aren't aware that while the antidepressants actually, this group of drugs, may work extremely well for some people, they clearly don't work well for others. And when you add up the numbers that they work well for versus the numbers that they work poorly for, on average, the antidepressants really don't work anything nearly as well for a group of 100 people, say, as most people think they do.
In the late 90s, at least to my awareness, there was talk of a possible chemical imbalance in the brain that accounted for depression. Do people still talk about that?
Yes, they do, but let me actually explain it. This was a theory that was outlined first back in, say, the 1960s, and the people who were responsible for outlining this theory, first of all, during the 1960s, by the 1970s had felt that the theory was wrong. It gets resurrected during the 1990s because it provides wonderful marketing copy for pharmaceutical companies, but not because it's right. No leading cutting-edge neuroscientist thinks that this is right, but it has become wonderful marketing copy for the group of drugs. But it's not a, shall we say, politically neutral marketing copy. For instance, the SSRI group of drugs, as I've said to you, are now being marketed to people who are anxious, where once they were marketed to people who are actually depressed. Now, when they were being marketed to people who are depressed, you heard loads of talk about lowered serotonin levels. Now that they're being marketed to people who are anxious, you also hear talk about lowered serotonin levels. But let's just go back to the events of when the planes flew into the Twin Towers. Pfizer then began to vigorously push Zoloft after September the 11th for post-traumatic stress disorder. And you were told when you went on this pill that, look, when you get PTSD, there's lowered serotonin in your brain, and our pill will put that right. This implies that if something awful goes wrong in the world, that actually the fault is in you. It isn't in the world. There isn't anything in the world that needs to be changed. What needs to be changed is something in you, and our pill will do that changing for you. So the whole idea about lowered serotonin levels in people who've got nervous problems isn't just good marketing copy for the pharmaceutical companies, it's also politically loaded marketing copy.
Would you like to explain what you mean by that?
Politically loaded in that it kind of suggests, as I've said, that the fault is in the person who has the nervous problem, rather than the fault being in the world, which actually may need to be changed.
Happiness and sunbeams and cute little puppy dogs, these are the things that I've seen with my heart. Life is a happy game if you don't forget to smile, but every now and then your face, it harbors a frown. Sadness is a barnacle clinging to your bright boat. You won't let it sink your spirits if you'll only learn to float. We are all sea captains sailing on life's rough seas. Come on, you Magellans, come with me. I've got pie, happiness pie. I guess you're wondering what's in this pie. Well, there's 2 cups love, 1.5 cups of understanding, 1 tablespoon of good old-fashioned compassion, sugar to taste, and you know what? The ovens are our hearts. sad man in the corner. He is gross and he is old. People steal his shoes and make him eat mold. His life won't be bad if he does what he is told. He should be an alchemist and turn his pain into gold. Golden pie. Happy tailors, happy workers, happy farmers, happy girls, happy widowers, happy freelance artists, happy welders, happy world. Happy drinkers, happy thinkers, happy musicians, happy beauticians, happy mayors, happy pairs, happy call girls, happy hula boys.
Lowered serotonin levels actually been measured, evaluated, assessed, identified?
Absolutely not. No, there hasn't been any evidence for this at all. As I said, the idea about something like lowered serotonin levels came on stream during the 1960s, and people from then on have been trying to look at this in a whole range of ways, and 40 years later, there isn't any evidence at all of any lowering of serotonin levels in people who are either depressed or people with other nervous problems.
How do you see the future in terms of treatment for depression?
Well, I think, in actual fact, that the pharmaceutical companies would much prefer to market compounds to people who are anxious than, say, to people who are depressed. I think the next generation of compounds, when they come on stream, are probably going to be marketed as anxiolytics rather than pills for a mood disorder, and what this will lead to is an apparent shrinking back in the number of people who are being thought of as being clinically depressed and a growth in the number of people who are thought of as being anxious. We will move from the age of depression that we've had during the 1990s back to an age of anxiety disorders. The other issue is, will we get pills that really do much more than the pills we have now? And it's hard to know where those pills will actually come from. At this point in time, there's no real evidence that there's any breakthrough pill that's going to appear during the next 4 or 5 years that's actually going to transform the treatment of either people with a mood disorder or people with other nervous problems.
Will the pharmaceutical industry try to predict mental illness through the human genome?
Well, I had thought that they would. More to the point that they'd have tried to actually use pharmacogenetics to actually predict whether you're going to respond to their pill or not, so that they could screen out people who weren't going to respond to the pill. Now, I think the...
Prevent them from being born.
Not prevent them from... No. Just when you would go along to your GP, for instance, he or she would be able to do a blood test before you took Prozac or Zoloft. That would pick up whether you're likely to respond to this pill or not, so that, you know, if you looked like the kind of person who wasn't going to respond to these pills, then you wouldn't be put on them, and the risks, therefore, would be actually reduced. But while I think the industry can do quite a bit of this kind of work now, that they have the capacity to bring on stream blood tests like this, they haven't done so. And I think the problem is for the pharmaceutical companies that the Human Genome Project and the range of genetic tests that could come from this have in recent years begun to seem much less attractive to the pharmaceutical industry than they once did. I think what people are actually beginning to appreciate is that a range of disorders like diabetes, there's an eye problem, which appears to be one illness called retinitis pigmentosa. It now turns out there are something like 80 different genes actually involved or can cause in one way or the other this illness. So even if we do find out all of the genes, it seems much less likely that there'll be one gene for each illness. And if there isn't one gene for each illness, there isn't going to be one pill or one cure for each illness either. So the whole genetic area, I think, is looking less attractive to the major pharmaceutical companies than it once did.
Do you see any other trends?
These things do swing. Post-World War II, I think we were in a very group-oriented period where the general feeling was that group efforts, whether by the nation-state or by groups within the state, that people could help themselves through mutual or cooperative work or effort of one sort or the other. Our belief in this kind of approach seems to have waned, and we're in a much more individualistic phase of the cycle now at the moment. It's each person for themselves. And if you're having problems, the problem is one that we tend to locate much more in you rather than in the world per se. And we tend to think of trying to change you as opposed to trying to change the world. History kind of suggests that we tend to swing between these poles, though, that we will ultimately swing back toward a less individualistic way of seeing things and much more towards a group-oriented way of seeing things. Unfortunately, it tends to be major wars and things going wrong of one sort or the other that tends to get us acting more in terms of the interests of the group rather than just the interests of the individual. And while it may be awfully good to say, look, a group ethos would be helpful, no one would really wish for the kind of war or the global warming kind of scenario that might lead to that swing of the pendulum.
Would you allow me to ask you a question about the U of T?
Sure, yeah, okay. Please do.
Well, in June of 2001, there were reports in the mainstream media about the University of Toronto having rescinded their offer to you of two high-profile positions, one as clinical director of the Mood and Anxiety Disorders Program at their Center for Addictions and Mental Health, and the other as a full professor in the U of T Department of Psychiatry because of comments you made about Prozac. What do you think was the reason for that?
Well, the problems happened about half a year prior to that. What had happened was I'd given a lecture at the U of T, and the lecture gave a précis, gave the plot of a book that has since come out on the market called The Creation of Psychopharmacology. In the lecture, I looked at where the field has come from and where it may be headed to. Now, in the middle of all this, I made what were fairly minor points about Prozac. This was not a lecture about Prozac per se. It was a lecture which included the relatively minor point that I believe that Prozac can cause hazards. And, well, I actually put it to the audience that not all the people in the audience would actually agree with me that there were the problems with the Prozac group of drugs that I think there are, but that what everybody would have to agree with was that there had been a controversy about this group of drugs. And they'd also have to agree that since the controversy blew up, there's been no research done to look at the issues involved. Now, that was the key point, as opposed to saying that Prozac itself could cause problems. The key point was, are we actually researching the hazards when there are good grounds to do so? And I was saying, no, we're not. And in the context of the lecture, I was trying to say how we'd ended up at the point where we weren't doing the kinds of things that most people would have thought that we should be doing. Now, in the wake of that lecture, my job offers, as you pointed out, were withdrawn. It turned out that at the lecture in question, one of the other lecturers on the platform that day was a Dr. Charles Nemiroff from Georgia, who is a major consultant for several of the major pharmaceutical companies. Dr. Nemiroff made it clear to people within the U of T that he didn't particularly like my views, that he thought that the work that I was doing wasn't all that good. It's the kind of point that he's made clear to me previously, but he made it in a very vigorous way, it would seem, on the day of the lecture, and he made it to a few different people within the U of T. I believe that what happened was the fuss that was generated by him offering these views was what led to the withdrawal of the job offer.
You're less suspicious of a possible influence of corporate donors such as Lilly, the manufacturer of Prozac, which is the center's largest sponsor.
Well, you see, these things rarely work with, say, the CEO from one of the major pharmaceutical companies actually picking up the phone to someone within the U of T and saying, look, we really don't want you to go ahead with this job offer to Healy. That's just not the way these things work. I think it's much more a case of the university or various different universities will feel that there's lots at stake, and they will be cautious about someone who they think might compromise funding. Now, in actual fact, I've worked very, very closely with the pharmaceutical industry throughout my career.
You've had access to their documents.
Well, that's as part of a legal action. But quite apart from that, I've actually been a consultant for most of the major pharmaceutical companies. I've worked very closely with them. And it's not clear to me that there wasn't a failure of nerve there on the part of the U of T, for instance. I think pharmaceutical companies don't necessarily want universities to just roll over. I think the role of universities should be to raise the bar for the pharmaceutical companies, that they should challenge pharmaceutical companies to actually look at hazards of their drugs, to produce better drugs than they are actually producing. That if you don't raise the bar for the pharmaceutical companies, they'll perform much less well than they would otherwise do.
As a practicing psychiatrist, when and why do you prescribe an antidepressant?
The first thing to say is that I believe these pills can be very, very helpful for people who are either depressed or people who've got nervous problems of one sort or the other. I believe when trying to help people with these problems that what needs to happen is they need to be told what the risks and the hazards of the pills are, what the likelihood is that the pill that I'm going to put them on, the pill that I think perhaps we should try first, is one that will help them or not. There are very, very few people that I see who necessarily have to have a pill. Most people who are actually depressed have a kind of condition that will often clear up of its own accord if both the person involved and me, if I'm involved in trying to look after them, are prepared to actually to be patient. And I let people know this also, that all they need to do may be to just wait. Apart from just waiting, however, there are a range of things that they can do to help themselves. And then, if those fail, there are pills that we can use also. So there are a small group of people who I would recommend to go on pills fairly quickly. There's a larger group of people who would have the option of either waiting for a period of time or perhaps going on to pills. And then there's a further group of people who are being put on pills now, where I would say, no, they oughtn't to be put on these pills. And these tend to be people who are more mildly ill, mildly nervous, mildly depressed, people who are in their teens, people who are undergoing stresses of various sorts, where really what they need is to be told, just wait for a while. This will clear up.
Do you have any ideas about long-term effects on human health having to do with antidepressants?
We really don't know what the long-term impact will be. I think in the case of some of the older antidepressant group of drugs, I think the risks to long-term health don't seem to be all that severe. But what we're looking at here is a group of pills we use to treat people who are more severely depressed, where the risks of leaving that group of people untreated were fairly considerable. What we've now got with the newer group of drugs like Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil is a group of drugs which act much more potently on the serotonin system in the brain, and we don't really know what the impact of long-term potent treatment on this brain system will be. There's increasing evidence that people can get hooked to it so that when they try to stop, they aren't able to. There's also increasing evidence that people get a range of problems, such as movement problems of one sort or the other, when they're actually exposed to these drugs long-term. And there's also increasing evidence that some people may be sensitized to the drugs so that when they try to halt them, they become depressed again very, very quickly. And this seems to lead on to a need for longer or more chronic treatment. And this may not be all that good. Within all this, one of the other things to bear in mind is that where once we would have been giving these pills to people who are just severely depressed, these drugs are now being used for people who are fairly young, in their teens or even younger, and they've been used for much milder problems than we would have once treated. And where you might be prepared to put up with certain hazards treating a severe problem, really, you know, it becomes a much trickier problem when you're giving these drugs long-term to people who are much more mildly ill.
There may be a segment of the antidepressant pill-taking population that may be taking more than one from different categories.
Yes, I think this is one of the problems we have at the moment now, which is that people seem to be put on a pill, and when they actually develop problems with that pill, either it fails to work quite as well as it was once working, or they may get a range of different side effects on the first pill that they've been put on. They seem to then get put on second pills and even third or fourth pills to try and minimize the problems being caused by the first pill.
Right. In the postscript to your book, The Antidepressant Era, you write an argument for making antidepressants available over the counter. Would you like to tell us about it just a bit?
Well, no, I don't. And this is a point that people pick up on in the book and misread, I think, slightly, which is what I'm doing in the postscript in the book is I'm just asking people to actually consider what things would be like if the drugs were available over the counter. Now, I'm doing this as a means to try and bring out some of the hidden aspects to the way things are now. It's not a plea for making the drugs available over-the-counter. It's more a case of just saying, look, an awful lot of the way things have gone, the capacity of industry to sell illnesses to us happens because they're selling these pills to physicians like me. If the drugs were, say, available over-the-counter rather than through physicians only, what would have happened in the case of a drug like Prozac? It would have been sold like St. John's wort. Now, St. John's wort is sold to people over-the-counter, and it's sold for stress and burnout. Prozac is sold through a physician, and it's sold for depression. In order for me to give you Prozac, I've got to, as it were, make you depressed. If Prozac had been available over-the-counter, the industry would have sold it instead for stress and burnout, and you wouldn't have had all of the articles that you see in the medical press and in the lay press about how common it is nowadays for people to be depressed.
When
you just wouldn't have heard about that at all.
Make you depressed means identify you as depressed.
Hmm? Yes, and
label you.
Get you thinking that this is the nature of what you have, okay?
And that it's a disease.
And that it's, yes. I think the whole St. John's wort thing brings things out quite clearly, in that people aren't often hostile to pills per se. Like, most people are prepared to concede that at various different points in time I may get stressed or burnt out and I may need a pick-me-up of some sort or other, and they're prepared to go along and get something like St. John's wort from a health food store or whatever and try it out, and if it suits them, they're happy to go on having it. In the case of Prozac, however, you get most of us not absolutely sure we want to become depressed, as it were, and we're often less compliant with pills like that, partly because it isn't a case of just taking pills, it's a case of taking orders from a physician about what you should be doing and what you oughtn't to be doing, if you see what I mean. Mm. There's much less control of the process. So the object in trying to bring all this up at the end of the book was trying to show people how much of what we've been living through happens as a result of simple little things like making these drugs available on prescription only.
What about the empowerment of individuals faced with the decision of whether or not to take an antidepressant as prescribed by a physician? Do they have any choices?
It's awfully difficult. You are very dependent on the genuineness of the person treating you. And part of the problem at the moment is and this does come back to the issue of whether drugs should actually be available on prescription only or not. If, for example, you went along to buy a new car and you were told by the car dealer that you have to have a pink Audi, when in actual fact you wanted a blue Volvo or whatever, you'd be a bit miffed. You'd say, hey, look, you know, I came in here wanting a blue Volvo. Well, the way things are at the moment, when it comes to actually getting drugs for nervous problems, you're in the kind of situation where you go along to the dealer who says, this is what you're having. And you don't know whether the reason that I'm actually saying you should have drugs A, B, or C is because the representatives for the company that makes that drugs hasn't perhaps been the person through my office just before you, and I'm perhaps being taken to the Caribbean to a meeting or whatever to hear more about this wonderful drug A, B, or C. So it's the kind of situation where if drugs are going to be available on prescription only, you are critically dependent on the physician being really genuine with you and not being, in one way or the other, being bought by the pharmaceutical company.
The patient has to be an advocate for himself.
Well, I think, unfortunately, given the way physicians have behaved on this issue over the last 30 to 40 years, it really does mean that people should arm themselves with all of the information they can get from the internet and elsewhere, and perhaps even should think about having other people in with them when they're actually consulting for one problem or the other.
I do thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
And for your energy and answering all my questions. We've been speaking with Dr. David Healy, author of The Antidepressant Era, The Creation of Psychopharmacology, and many scholarly articles. He is the head of the Department of Psychological Medicine at the University of Wales College of Medicine, and he spoke to us from Bangor, North Wales. Thank you again very, very much.
Thank you.
To read the speech David Healy gave in Toronto that sparked the rescinding of his U of T contract, go to www.pharmapolitics.com. That's www.pharmapolitics.com. For information on serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, and others, the Prozac Survivors Support Group is a nonprofit independent organization based in the U.S. Their website is at www.pssg.org. That's www.pssg.org. The International Coalition for Drug Awareness is at www.drugawareness.org. That's www.drugawareness.org. If you are experiencing adverse reactions to a prescription drug, or would like to link up with other Canadian prescription drug consumers, contact PharmaWatch at the following email address, pharmawatch@pharmawatch.net. That's pharmawatch@pharmawatch.net. Next week, Farmed and Dangerous looks at grassroots consumer advocacy in the area of prescription drugs. We'll speak with John Kinlock of Project Genesis and Phil Nolan of the NDG Community Coalition on Healthcare, both in Montreal. And we'll talk to Ethel Mead of the Ontario Coalition of Senior Citizens Organizations in Toronto.
Farmed and Dangerous is produced by the Community News Collective at CKUT Radio McGill as part of its award-winning Long-Term Memory Radio series. Our thanks to all of those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. Stay tuned for Long-Term Memory Radio each and every Wednesday at 5 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on Real Audio on the World Wide Web at www.ckut.ca. This 10-part Farmed and Dangerous series is available in a set of CDs from Radio McGill. For more information, please give us a call at area code 514-398-6788 or visit our website at www.ckut.ca and click on Community News. This is Long-Term Memory Radio.
Hold that! I want to talk about drugs.
Heroin!
No, not heroin.
Speed!
No, not speed.
Hashish!
No, not even hashish.
Western blot!
No, not horse tranquilizers. I just heard about this new drug that makes you happy. I just want to say, fuck happy!
Some days it's dark. Some days I work. I work alone. I walk alone. Most days it's dark. Alone.
Hey!
I can't go on. This is bullshit. You people.
It was on a Monday morning. I was tired, my head was turning, and I couldn't face the thought of going back to work. And so I paid a visit to the doctor, and he gave me the once over. Said, don't worry, we'll soon have you on the go. You need pills,
pills, pills and pills, pills to take the pain away. Just swallow two, three times a day, you'll be as good as new. And we've got pills to make you happy, pills to pep you up and calm you down. It's magic what a pill can do.
So I took the dose as ordered, and my energy was restored. But I was twitching, I was itching, couldn't keep my body still. So I twitched right back to see the quack. Ah, yes, he says, we'll soon cure that. I'll just prescribe another little pill. You need
pills, pills, pills and pills. Pills to take the pain away. Just swallow two, three times a day. You'll be as good as new. And we've got pills to make you happy. Pills to pep you up and calm you down. It's magic what a pill can do.
Well, the twitching soon subsided. Then I couldn't open my eyelids. I was dozy, droopy, drowsy. I asked the doctor why. He just took a little look at his new multicolored booklet. Then he shook me from my slumber with a cry. You need
pills, pills, pills and pills. Pills to take the pain away. Just swallow two, three times a day. You'll be as good as new. And we've got pills to make you happy. Pills to pep you up and calm you down. It's magic what a pill can do.
Now my cupboard's overflowing with the pills that keep me going. I've got yellow, pink and orange ones. I can't think what they're for, but they look so reassuring. I suppose they must be curing me. I wonder how I ever coped before or without
pills, pills, pills and pills. Pills to take the pain away. Just swallow two, three times a day. You'll be as good as new. And we've got pills to make you happy. Pills to pep you up and calm you down. It's magic what the pill can do.
Now the drug firms are delighted, and they say I should be knighted, cos I keep their profits healthy. And they've got a super plan to launch a major operation to present me to the nation as a fully working model of a well-adjusted man. You need
pills, pills, pills and pills. Pills to take the pain away. Just swallow two, three times a day. You'll be as good as new. And we've got